Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once again we are venturing into the centre circle, but this is no ordinary fixture, shall I say. This is one of an exclusive number of fixtures that we all like to play in. But first of all, teammates for this occasion, on the right-hand side of midfield, Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, going to be great talking about what is a really fascinating book, I have to say. I mean, you know, it's easy to say that because the guy who wrote is one of our mates, but, you know, this stands on quality alone. It's a fantastic read, and looking forward to talking to him about the book today.
Brilliant. Absolutely one of our own. The best way to describe. On the left-hand side of this centre midfield three, Mr. Stephen Scragg. Stephen, welcome.
How are we doing, Stu?
Yeah, very, very good. I have to give you credit for the tagline that comes with this, and this is the book stag do.
It is. These are most definitely the book stag do's. No, these are just like the best podcasts. I mean, we love all the podcasts we do, but, you know, when it's one of the family, then, you know, it just has that extra edge to it. And it's also the fact that, you know, when it's not, we know how it feels, you know, because we've done it. So there's a certain kind of like pressure, a certain spotlight that's on you as kind of like being over the other side of the desk almost. You know, it's surreal for the first 5 minutes, and then once the first 5 minutes have gone, it's like, yeah, it's just like the greatest thing.
You're right. It is a surreal feeling, and it almost, Gary, it kind of almost feels like an interview. You feel as in like a job interview. You feel like you're being assessed, and it's never meant to feel like that. It's always meant to be joyous. But before you get to those first 5 minutes, or before the end of those first 5 minutes come where it becomes enjoyable, the first 5 minutes are quite terrifying, aren't they, Gary?
Yeah, they can be. the last thing you want to do is to sort of say, as you know, you think about the book, because all of a sudden, you know, having sat on that side table, as you know, as you have as well, and Steve has as well, all of a sudden your mind goes blank, even though it's something you've written. And the guy who's been speaking to me said he's read the book over 5 times today. I'm not sure that's true, but knowing this guy, he's prepared well.
Okay, so 1984-85 season, Everton had become champions of England for the first time in 15 years. The following season, they had to watch their title slip away across Stanley Park to Liverpool, which I guess is partly why you're here, Stephen. Despite having the country's leading goal scorer wearing the blue of Everton, in 86-87, with Lineker now off to Barcelona, the chances of the title returning to Goodison Park look remote. The Forgotten Champions tells the story of how a Howard Kendall-inspired Everton battled against the loss of Lineker, a crippling injury crisis, and the perils of plastic pitches to emerge as champions once more. And it gives me great pleasure because not only is it one of our own, but arguably my most favourite guest that we ever have on here, purely for the stories. And now he's written a full book of a story. It is my pleasure to introduce Mr. Paul McParland. Paul, welcome to your stag do.
Thanks, Stuart. I don't get invited to many stag do's these days, so I'm quite looking forward to this one. And to be in such elite and esteemed company just adds to the whole aura of the evening. So thank you for inviting me along, and I hope I don't disgrace myself in my antics this evening.
to be fair, that with the age of us three, we'll be done by about 9:30. I really wouldn't worry too much. It's a school night. I don't see us getting out of control. Paul, first of all, congratulations on the book. We've been incredibly lucky enough to get a read of it before its release. Like I say, you regale us of Everton stories every time we chat with you. But, and I've said this to Gary and Stephen and some of the authors that we get, it's always a great sign when you can read a book and you can hear the author's voice. It's like the audio book. You're laid in bed, reading it in your head, but it's actually, again, I think I've said this to Gary, it's like the person's laid next to you in the bed, which is a little bit weird and gets a bit crowded. But yeah, essentially, you've spent a good two or three nights with me, Paul, the last couple of weeks, just reading in my ear.
Yeah, there'd be nothing else about Stu. I hope it's meant as much Stu as it has to me.
So
there's a touch of the Eric and Ernie's about it in that respect, or Bert and Ernie from Sesame Street.
So obviously it was always going to be about Everton, Paul. So much to get into with regards to the book, so much to get into with how you found writing your first book, because, you know, it is your first book, and like I say, we've all been there having written our first book, and we all remember what that was like. But before we get into that, you know, just really, you know, we've done the intro and it's about the season. But if you just want to give us a little bit more about what this book is about and what it goes into.
Yeah, I mean, the main concept for the book is really to ensure that the Everton team that won their ninth title in 1986-87 season get their true place and recognition in footballing history. Because from my perspective, I just don't think that achievement got the accolade it deserved at the time. And as the years since that event have rolled on and rolled on, less and less people, you know, kind of reflect on what a tremendous achievement it was that season for Harry Kendall to put together a side to win the title. Bearing in mind that, you know, the season starts off with the total despondency and gloom that enveloped the blue half of the city after throwing away the chance of winning the double to the team across Stanley Park, which I'm still getting counselling for. And then on top of that, he had a crushing injury list where at least six, seven key players were not available for most of the season. And add to that, Harry Kendall brought in a number of what would be termed, you know, underwhelming signings to add to the team, who actually did a tremendous job in getting the team over the line. And I think also as well for me, for that 86-87 season, it was a bigger test of Kendall's. Kendall's most sternest test as a manager, because he had so many obstacles to overcome. The 84-85 side has gone down in history. You know, it's their achievements are documented in the tremendous Howard's Way film. And there is kind of a sense that the 86-87 team was just a continuation of that Howard's Way team, when in fact it wasn't. The team that won the league in 86-87, 50% of them did not play in that 84-85 team. But they're kind of being kind of put together, and people don't think there's a great deal of difference between the two sides, but there's a massive difference between the two sides. So when you look back at that season, to overcome the awfulness of having blown the double to Liverpool, and then to come back and win the league by 9 points at the end of that season, which is a fantastic achievement that really has gone under the radar. Even at the time it went under the radar, I think, you know, the day we lifted the title at Carrow Road with a 1-0 victory at Norwich, the coverage on national TV was 1 minute 15 seconds, 1 minute 15 seconds, and you've just won the league. And that's all it got. It wasn't on TV. There was no highlights package. It was covered on the news, and that was it. And bearing in mind the dearth of television options on a bank holiday Monday, how there's no highlights package, at the very least, for that tight win, I have absolutely no idea. And what quite another reason for writing the book was, nobody under the age of 40 who's an Everton fan can remember us winning the league. And I just find that incomprehensible as a supporter who's grown up used to winning titles and FA Cups. And I know I always have a discussion with my son before the game, you know, before the games normally, and he says to me, "How are we going to get on today, Dad?" And I'll say, "Oh, I think we'll win." And he looks at me and goes, "You always say that. Why do you always say that? It's okay for you. You've seen us win leagues. I've not seen us win anything in my lifetime." And for the younger generation of Evertonians, that is unfortunately is the case. So I just thought that this needs to be documented and not forgotten about. And as events have unrolled, and with the move to Brownie Moor Dock, looking certain now for the start of the 24-25 season, this is probably, sadly, Everton's last ever league title win at Goodison Park. And as such, it deserves to be commemorated. And that's the whole reason for writing the book.
That's not bad, Paul, to be fair. That's not a bad opening and a bad opening pitch. Great start. Hopefully you feel a bit more relaxed now.
Are we done?
Yeah, that's it. Well done. It was a really good podcast. Thanks for that. Good luck with the book.
Cheers, thank you. Well.
I'll come to you first, Stephen. You know, it's interesting what Paul says about, you know, the lack of recognition, lack of television coverage. And do you think that, obviously, I think I'm right in saying it was a 15-year gap until the 84-85 title win. Do you think that second title win coming so close to the first one that did have a big gap, do you think that in some way affects how that second one was seen? And then I guess, and Paul just mentioned it there about it being a sort of nearly a 40 people under the age of 40. At the time, I mean, I wouldn't know because I don't support a team that will ever do this, but at the time, if you've won two league titles in 3 years, an FA Cup, a Cup Winners' Cup, you don't expect to not win it again relatively quickly.
Yes. Also with that as well, I mean, you can point to, say, someone like Derby County winning the league title 71-72 and then 74-75. And, you know, a lot is made of Clough's success in 71-72 and less so. You tend to hear less so about 74-75. So, you know, as well as that, you do get that concept that for any team that rises to trophy-winning success, those initial impact victories have the biggest kind of imprint almost for a lot of people. Not for everyone, for a lot of people. And then the latter successes, for some, are kind of like almost taken for granted. You know, it becomes kind of like an expected thing. But within that, you know, once that last success, there's always got to be a last success for any rise of a team. And the fact that this is Everton's last success, I mean, they still win the FA Cup kind of like 8 years later. But, you know, that's an entirely different Everton by then. You know, so it is a complex thing. So, like, I used to work with a Man United fan, for instance, when I used to work in Manchester, and not long after they'd beaten Bayern Munich in the Champions League final, I can remember having a conversation with him saying, you know, is it the biggest thing, you know, is it the biggest success? Was it the biggest thrill of all the things you've seen your team win? Is that the biggest thrill? And he said no. He said, and he backtracked to 91 on the Cup Winners' Cup final because it was that first time around syndrome almost. You know, those are the ones that people will tend to have as a recall. You know, no matter how many times we'll go out and buy a new CD or a new album, we'll always have, you know, a reset album that we'll go back to over and over and over again. And that's how it goes with successes. You know, those initial ones are the ones that make the deepest impact for a hell of a lot of people, which means that the later successes that come and follow that can fall under the radar. And that's what makes Paul's book so brilliant, is that it illuminates one of these that, you know, falls under the radar for a hell of a lot of people, and even for some Blues as well.
And to be fair, it's a great link. So what I was going to say to you, Gary, is, you know, again, we come to, you know, we talk about this so often about stories that need telling, and not necessarily that Everton's last league title campaign needs telling, but clearly it does to Everton fans, clearly it does to historians. And again, and it's so important that the people who tell these stories are people who have lived it, been there, and has been as close to it as possible.
Yeah, you know, we're all football geeks, and when I was a kid, I used to be able to recite every FA Cup winners from 1960 and every league champion from 1960 onwards. But I got to about, you know, 23. It got a bit difficult, and now it's 60-odd. It's impossible. But, I mean, you know, I remember Everton winning the title, but I remember precious little about it. And a lot of the reasons why I found out while reading Paul's book. And, you know, it's called The Forgotten Champions. It could have been The Unseen Champions, because there's so much of Everton's success that actually wasn't seen by anybody on TV, anybody outside the ground, other than brief highlights. And can you imagine a situation now where a team wins the title and there's 1 minute 15 seconds of coverage on the news? You know, it's not even live, it's not even recorded, let alone perishing live. And, you know, it's a championship that I knew Everton awarded, but I couldn't remember very much about it, which I think is sort of echoes the point that Paul's making in the book. And, you know, it's the reason that that it's written, and it fills in so many gaps. It fills in so many gaps for me. As I say, you remember Everton winning the title, but the story of it is really, I mean, truly extraordinary, considering the hurdles they had to cross to get to the title.
And this is just a question for you, Paul, that that isn't rehearsed. but it's okay. Obviously, I mean, you're a passionate Everton fan. You know, people who are regular listeners of the podcast will know, you know, you know your sort of love affair with Everton. And again, being polite, your history with Everton goes back quite a way. So you've seen them play for a number of years. And this was your first book. So in theory, you have all of Everton to go at in terms of writing your first book. I'm assuming it was always going to be about Everton once you'd taken the plunge to write a book. Were there any other areas that you'd thought about writing, other campaigns, other topics to do with Everton? Or once you'd decided to commit to a book, was it always going to be about this particular season?
Yeah, I think, Stu, out of all the possible avenues I could have explored, this was the one season I wanted to write about, because I think 62-63, I was seven, so I don't remember much about that. 69-70, I was 14. You remember bits of it, but the two titles in the mid-80s are most firmly in my mind. Now, the 84-85 one's been, you know, well-documented. The Howard's Way film, you know, tells that story in a way I couldn't even possibly hope to emulate. So really, I just wanted to... I want to concentrate on this season for some of the reasons I outlined at the start there, because, you know, it was our last league title. It is probably our last ever league title, because of part. And I'd have been 30, 31 then when we won this title. So I was at most of the games. So I remember it vividly. I also wanted to paint a bit of a picture of what it was like watching football in the 1980s as well, because it wasn't always all seats at stadiums. It wasn't always security checks to get your tickets for the game. You know, you could turn up as an away fan at Villa Park, at Hillsborough, whatever, on the day with your cash in hand and walk in and watch the game. And those aspects of football, I think, have kind of been lost slightly. And I've always been a firm believer in the oral history of football also has to survive alongside the written history of football as well, because, you know, as you three will well know, when you're researching things, you come across so many untruths that apparently did not happen, are factually incorrect, that you start to doubt yourself, was that really the case? So it's good just to, you know, to reassure yourself that your memories actually are, you know, an accurate account of how that season developed. And I wanted to tell the story of how the season about, because to me it's a fascinating season, from the depths of despair at the start to winning the league with a huge injury toll to cope with, and then ending in the worst way possible by having Kendall leaving for Bilbao. And then since then we've had two top four finishes in 34 years. So this book was just crying out to be written, in my opinion.
And like I say, and I'm sure Everton fans are so grateful to you. And Gary's right. You know, we're all fans of football. I can, you know, I can read any book about football and, you know, and really enjoy it and see the value in it. But again, this is a campaign that I do remember. You're right, there wasn't a lot of TV coverage, but that Everton side, you know, certainly in the early to mid 80s, certainly I took a lot of interest in, as we know, you know, without really committing to a team. You know, I was happy to watch any side that I could. So once we get into it then, in terms of, there's the 84-85 title success, that was preceded by the FA Cup. There's European glory. Then the double is done by Liverpool and Everton finish runners-up in the FA Cup in the league. At the start of this campaign, was there optimism that it was, and this is no offence to Stephen, because I'll get his opinion in a minute, Was there a feeling that it was only on loan at Anfield at the start of that season?
I think that's not an unfair comparison, Stu. I think that the natural state of most Evertonians is pessimism. So there was this dreadful innate fear that the 84-85 campaign had been a one-off. And when you looked at Everton's previous title history, you could understand the reason for people thinking that. I mean, we won the title in 62-63. It took another 7 years to win the title again. We won it in 1970, and then we didn't win it for 15 years. So you can understand the innate caution that most Everton's, you know, would express about their title chances at the start of the season. Factoring on top of that as well, the loss of the leading goal scorer, Gary Lineker. Factoring on top of that as well, the crippling injury list. Even worse, the worst news of that summer was that Juventus had loaned Ian Rush back to Liverpool for the year. That actually sent this huge dark cloud heading towards Goodison Park that kind of hovered over the stage over the whole season. So there were, you know, from an Everton perspective, there weren't many reasons to be hugely optimistic. The only thing that kind of gave us a bit of lift was one, the fact that Howard Kendall hadn't departed for Barcelona, as he seemed to be almost on the verge of doing. So we kept the same management team, but there were very, very few reasons for the majority of Everton fans to feel optimistic at the start of that season.
I mean, I'll come to you, Stephen, obviously, like I say, you know, it's great that we have a blue perspective and a red perspective of what, when you actually look back at it, it's, and we've talked about this in a previous podcast about where clubs, I can't remember which series, but we looked at how clubs from the same city, you know, sort of the peaks and troughs seem to coincide, one will rise and one will fall. But this sort of period really, you know, sort of for 4 or 5 years was very much a to-ing and fro-ing between Everton and Liverpool. And, you know, Liverpool had had their own way domestically for such a long time, and then Everton arrive and they take it, and then obviously you take it back with the double, which, you know, which must seem quite sweet from the red half of Liverpool. But then, obviously, it eventually goes back to Everton again that season. At the start, I suppose, same question to you, at the start of that season, did you foresee Everton putting up another strong title campaign?
Yes. You know, I think from a red perspective, the threat was only ever going to come from Goodison at that point in time. I mean, you say Liverpool had it their own way for a long time, and yes, there was this longevity of success. But throughout that success, Liverpool always had a running mate alongside them throughout all that time. You know, early 1970s to mid-1970s, you know, Leeds United, Derby County. You know, along came Forest in the late 70s. You know, Aston Villa then took over early 80s. And then along came Everton. There were a few others who, you know, came close and didn't quite win it. QPR, Man City, Ipswich Town under Bobby Robson. We'd always had someone that kept pace with us for a short period of time, a short blast, and then fell away. And Everton were the latest one. But there seemed to be... certainly at that point in time, the summer of 1986, going into the new season, I think we only really saw it as being Everton. You know, we didn't feel the threat from Manchester United. They'd had this, you know, amazing blowout at the beginning of 85-86, where they'd won the first 10 games, 10 points clear, and then finished fourth. You know, they were you know, overtaken not just by Liverpool and Everton, but West Ham as well. And we knew that psychologically that was wounding for them, and that you know, Atkinson was had to get it right, or that was it. So we knew that they were falling apart somewhat. It was Everton. You know, even Arsenal at that point in time, they'd just sacked Don Howe and replaced him with George Graham, who was the Millwall manager. And I don't think anyone was particularly worried about Arsenal at that point in time. Spurs were just Spurs, as in them, you know, I think we all saw them as a cup side. They were never going to be a threat for winning the league title. You know, Nottingham Forest were quite an interesting prospect because they played a lot of very good football at that point in time. Very expansive, very imaginative football. But they would always have this part of the season where the wheels would fall off, so they'd fall away. So yes, you know, as far as we were concerned, you know, it was Everton were going to be the threat.
And I mean, I suppose, you know, we can carry this round as well, you know, to you, Gary, from a Chelsea perspective, who were clearly a long way from the Chelsea that they are today. Watching at a distance, shall we say, at what was happening in Merseyside, you know, did you sort of appreciate, not only appreciate what Everton were doing, but appreciate that there was potentially a dynasty and a long-term threat to Liverpool? Or did you perceive it as Stephen's mentioned, you know, Villa win a title, Forest win a title, but they can't back it up like Liverpool could?
Yeah, I mean, as you say, titles and Chelsea were a long way apart then. I mean, Chelsea won the title in 1955 and I was born the following year, and they took them bloody 50 years to win the damn thing again. And so it was always a long way away. But yeah, from a distance, I have to say that selling Lineker to Barcelona, well, Lineker going to Barcelona, I'm sure that, you know, Everton weren't probably chuffed, but these things happen. Losing to Barcelona, the top scorer in the league, hardly suggested to me that Everton were going to come back and win the title. And yet, I can't remember the exact details, but some in the sort of early 2000s, there was about 7 or 8 seasons, 10 seasons, where the team that won the title didn't have the league's top scorer. Because, and Paul really refers to this really well in the book, it's better spread the goals out. Because if you're all your eggs in one basket, the basket gets nicked and totters off to Catalonia, you're kiboshed. But Kendall dealt with that situation really well. But personally, I couldn't see that happening. I mean, you know, I know Stevie says, and I suppose you get a close perspective being Liverpool fan or where Everton are, but I say being from a distance, you know, they've won the title, lost the title, and perhaps shouldn't have done, but they fell over the last few hurdles. And they seem to be going backwards to Helen Lineker. So I didn't see them as potential champions, but, you know, that's football, you know. It makes mugs of us all.
It's a fascinating comment, actually, and it's something that's always interesting. I was always a huge Lineker fan, Paul. But just before we sort of move on again with the campaign and stuff, just one question. More than one question, clearly, as I'll start with one. One, how good was Lineker? He was only there a season. You know, he came from Leicester, was only there for one season. And two, was there as an Everton fan, how does it feel, or how did it feel when you sort of take a player to the next level, which Everton did? You know, he went from Leicester to Everton, which was a massive step up. He goes to the World Cup, Golden Boot, and then he's gone again within a single season. How good was he? And then how does it feel? Was it a sense of betrayal, or is it just an acceptance as a football fan?
Well, I think it's fair to say Gary Lineker divided the opinion amongst the Everton fan base hugely. Gary Lineker's main problem was he wasn't Andy Gray, and he replaced Andy Gray. And Andy Gray was an almost impossible figure to replace for the Goodison fans. So straight away, he had a massive challenge to try and prove himself to be as good as Andy Gray. No Everton fan wanted Andy Gray to leave. We credit Andy Gray with single-handedly lifting the club and turning around from his arrival in age 34. Andy Gray's relationship with the fans was like nothing I've known in recent times. He celebrated every goal like he was on the Gladys Street. You watch him during the game, berating his players, berating the referee. He lifted the whole team with his attitude, manner and performance. Now, Gary Lineker was a different type of personality. He didn't have that instant rapport with the crowd. And it didn't help that he didn't score in his first four games for Everton, one of which we lost away at Leicester City as well. So straight away, people started to question how good a signing he was. The Leicester page of the Liverpool Echo, the football ping on a Saturday evening, were full of some quite strong criticisms about Gary Lineker, about how he wasn't Andy Gray, how we wasted a lot of money bringing him to the club. And it's quite interesting as well, I interviewed Kevin Ratcliffe for the Boot. And he was saying the summer before Everton signed Lineker, Howard Kendall approached him and asked his opinion about Gary Lineker. And Ratcliffe said at the time, to be honest, whenever I played against him, he's not caused me any problems. The one who has caused me problems is actually Alan Smith, the other forward. You know, I think if you're going to buy anyone, you should go for him. But Kendall had done his research and decided, no, Lineker was the one. So it took Lineker a while to win fans over. I think by the time he scored the goal in the derby at February in Anfield when we won 2-0, I think there was an acceptance then that, you know, he was a good goal scorer and needs to be recognised for that. But there was always a feeling that season that our style of football was better in 84 or 85 when we played through midfield a lot more, because quite often the tactics seem to be with Lineker, hit the ball quickly for Lineker to run onto to play through his strengths. And we kind of lost a bit of the style and finesse of the 84-85 team because of that. And that was reflected in the lack of goals from the midfield in particular in that season. So Lineker does certainly divide opinion amongst the fan base. I think as well, when you have these ideas in your head, and sometimes it's quite instructive to go back and check them out. And Lineker scored 30 goals that season, which on its own sounds fabulous. He scored five of those goals after there was nothing to play for. So if you take that out of the equation, suddenly you're looking at 25 goals as opposed to 30. And on the title running, there was a spell from when he scored at Aston Villa on the 1st of March. And the next 10 league games, he scored one goal. Now, bearing in mind, you know, that was a crucial part of the season when Liverpool started to claw ground back on Everton. I've kind of readjusted my thoughts on Lineker's contribution that season, because if you ask me honestly, Stu, I mean, I was always an Andy Gray man as opposed to Gary Lineker man. Obviously, it hurt that he left us. It hurt the sense that he left us. But then again, he alienated most of the fan base with his performance on the World Cup panel, making these jokes in Spanish about what his next club was going to be. And he, for a lot of Everton fans like myself, he never really endeared himself to the club. And it also rankled that for a number of years after leaving Everton, he never references Everton's career at all. You mentioned there, Stu, that Everton made Gavin Lineker, and they did. That was a season that propelled them onto the world stage and led to that tremendous performance in the World Cup. There's always been this niggling feeling amongst Everton fans that Lineker's never given due recognition for how we improved his game, how we turned into a world-class forward. So, yes, he was good in 85, 86, but at the end of the day, we won the title with Andy Gray. We did it with Gary Lineker.
Can't argue with the facts, Paul. I've got to say, you can't argue with the facts. Okay, so the book is brilliant. It's like I say, I can hear you in every word and every sentence. I was reading it. The season for me, the underlying story here is one of almost adversity against injury. It just seems to be an eternal battle to find fit players.
Yeah, I think that's a really good summation of the season, Stu. I mean, when you think when we started the league campaign against Nottingham Forest in that August, you know, we were missing Neville Southall and goal, who arguably at the time was the best goalkeeper in Europe. We were also missing.
Agreed. Absolutely agreed.
We're missing Gary Stevens, who just played in the World Cup and at right back. We're missing Derek Mountfield, whose goals in 84-85 have been crucial for the league title win. We're missing Pat Van Den Howe, who was out with another one of his mysterious social-related injuries. We're missing Peter Reid and Paul Bracewell in midfield. So basically, six key players from the 84-85 team were not available. Add on to that as well, Gary Lineker leaving, and you can see how bereft the squad was of depth. So I think in the first few games of the season, we had Ian Marshall at centre-half. Now, I know Ian Marshall went on to have a good career as a striker, both at Oldham Athletic and Leicester City. But for some reason, Everton made this weird decision to send him to a centre-back, which clearly was not his strongest position. He was always a far better striker. Then we brought in the likes of Neil Adams from Stoke City. We brought in Kevin Langley from Wigan Athletic. The previous years, we brought in Warren Aspinall and loaned them back to Wigan. So he was now available at 86, 87. So there were no key big money signings at that stage before the season started. Then Kendall brought in Paul Power, which was a decision that just totally bemused the fan base. Nobody could see why on earth he'd gone for this aging 32-year-old veteran who'd achieved nothing in his career of note so far. And there's just this feeling he'd come for one final payday. And then the big summer signing turned out to be Dave Watson. And once again, he was always had the issue in the background that A, he was replacing another fan's favourites in Derek Mountfield, and B, he was clearly a Liverpool fan and an ex-Liverpool player. So he had quite an obstacle to overcome there to establish himself in the team. So given the lack of depth we had in that side at the start of the season, I think, it just tested Kendall's managerial genius to another level to be able to get a set of results out from that team. And one thing that they were really good at the start was grinding out results. Quite often, most of the goals came in the second half. They stayed in games and they hung on and they would snatch a draw, they would snatch a win. And certainly until the end of September, I think we were unbeaten in the league and we surpassed all expectations. But at some stage, those injuries were going to kick in, players were going to lose form, and that was then going to be the true test of how our season unraveled.
It's funny, I've made a note for my next question for Stephen, and my next question was going to be, it's situations like this where a manager's talent is actually really to be seen, or, and as Paul mentioned towards the end, his ability to hold a team together and make them believe what can still be achieved?
Yes, it's all to do with taking football away from the individual, which was why Liverpool and Everton as well succeeded so well, at that point in time. I think we looked at a lot of other teams, and this is why I was saying that Everton still seemed a threat to us, was that the vast majority of the teams seemed to be, powered by an omnipresent individual. At Spurs, it was Glenn Hoddle. Manchester United, just everything seemed to be Brian Robson. Even though both of those two teams had plenty of talented players apart from them. And it was something that kind of like swept into the England team as well, because Bobby Robson used to have this fixation with Brian Robson that was just to the point of obsession. There was a blinkered nature that made him kind of like, you know, miss many other great players that were around. And this is what Liverpool and Everton did, is broke away from that, is that they built a team, they had a template and a vision and a style of play. And what they would do is find the right components to fill the places. And this is what Howard Kendall did this season. You know, he had his set plan, and then he would just put, it's like putting a jigsaw together. You know, one piece isn't available. It's all right. There is another piece that slots in. And this is what happened throughout this season. And this is what, you know, the best teams do. You know, they problem solve. The best managers, you know, spin the plates and they find, you know, they problem solve. You know, I'm a great believer in, you know, one injury to one player is an opportunity to another. And Paul Power is a huge example of this. Alan Harper, who's another name that, you know, pops up time and time again throughout Paul's book. You know, the vital components that can slot into many different places. And this is where it's having that strength of mind to say, look, we've lost one player. That doesn't mean everything falls apart. The collective is everything. And there are more than one answer. There's more than one answer to the questions that are being posed.
I'll come back to you in a Paul. I'll come back to you in a sec, Paul, about Paul Power and Alan Harper. But just for you, Gary, we'll get Paul's take on Howard Kendall. But I'm after a neutral perspective at the moment. He wins the FA Cup. He wins the league title. He wins the Cup Winners' Cup. Is this second league title his greatest achievement in your opinion?
Yeah, I think it is because not only had he lost. Lineker, and he had to sort of restructure the team to go back to what they used to do before. But considering all the hurdles they faced in that season, Paul's just listed that half a dozen players, excuse me, who were injured at the start of the season. It's not a matter that they were first team players, the first choice players. These were absolute stars, you know, as Paul said, Neville Southall, far and away the best goalkeeper in Britain and probably in Europe as well. Kevin Ratcliffe was a fantastic defender. I can imagine him in modern terms being a libero. He got everything, pace, power, great in the air. I mean, wonderful player. He had to cope with so many things kind of kicking against Everton's chances. And not only the fact that Liverpool were, you know, defending champions, double winners, and, you know, looked like they were going to win the league again. I think it is his greatest achievement.
Paul, we've been lucky to have Paul Power on a podcast for a long time as well, if I remember correctly. I think it's still the record for the longest ever podcast. A wonderful guy to talk to. He was fascinating. He was wonderful to listen to. It was great to interview. But again, apart from the person that he was, his, you know, like you just said there, sort of almost disbelief and the questioning of Howard Kendall by Everton fans as to what was the purpose of this signing. What's your, I don't mean your overriding opinion of Paul Power, the footballer, but in terms of that season, what was it that he brought?
Well, I think... The best way you can credit Paul Power for that season is he fitted into that side like he'd been a regular since his teens, because he played his first few games at left back and he looked like he was a natural for that position, and he impressed fans with his pace, because he was, even in his mid 30s, he's probably still one of the fastest players in the club. I mean, Alan Harper told me the players nicknamed him Peter Pan in training. The dude's just so impressed about how quick he was, how fast he was, and how well he looked after himself. And it was also his adaptability, because he starts off on left back, and then when Kevin Sheehan was moved to centre midfield, which was also a vital part of that season as well, Paul Power seamlessly slotted in on the left side of midfield as well. And if you look at clips of that season on YouTube, some of his bursts down the left wing for crosses and assists to create goals were just absolutely brilliant. And he scored four goals that season, which I think was his best tally since 80-81. And from someone who came in as a bit part player, he became an indispensable part of the team, and that's the biggest credit you can give to him. And I think, as I mentioned in the book as well, by the end of the season, though, he was voted Joint Player of the Year by the supporters, along with Kevin Ratcliffe. Now, when you think of the other players in that Everton team as well, that is some achievement for a player who came in with, and the fan base had no expectations he was going to add to, he was going to aid our title bid that season at all. And it was kind of another indication of at that time, Kendall almost had the Midas touch as a manager. And you know, although people question his decision, he invariably proves to be the correct decision. And I think from Howard Kendall's perspective, he took great satisfaction at the end of the season in reminding people that, you know, some people questioned the signing of Paul Power. You know, we knew he was always going to be such a tremendous asset to the team. And I think as well, Paul Power had been captain at Man City, so he also brought a captain's perspective to the side as well. So he was quite ready to stand up and shout instructions to have a go at people they weren't performing. And one of the big things about that 86-87 side was they had captains throughout the team. You had Ian Snowden, who came as captain for Leeds United as well. You had Kevin Ratcliffe, who was the captain there. You had Paul Power from Man City. So there's a real number of leaders in the team. And Paul Power was certainly a leader, and his impact in that season cannot be underestimated.
Sometimes, as you mentioned there, you talked about Brian Robson, Glenn Hoddle, you know, players that are forever associated with clubs, and, you know, sometimes they stay as one club players, but, you know, and Hoddle and Robson, you know, sort of eventually move on. But Paul Power, it's so difficult when you are so ingrained with a club and you've been club captain, you've been there for such a long time, to then have such an impact and have such it's almost like a second career and a second coming, but it's actually in such a really short microcosm of the career, but such is their contribution that, you know, it's almost like two different people. It's Man City's Paul Power and it's Everton's Paul Power. And it seems they are such rarities in the game.
They are, but what they tend to offer is something of a rebirth. You know, there's suddenly this Indian summer that's been offered. And when a player comes along, and because we had it with Gary McAllister, you know, and it's a player that's kind of like deemed to be past it, but people look at the age, they'll look at the number, you know, and then they'll not look beyond that at what they bring to the team. You know, it's that experience, it's the class, it's the intelligence, it's the enthusiasm, and then amidst all that, in some way, that player is kind of incredulous that they're even there. So they kind of grasp it with both hands and just play it, you know, for the sheer enjoyment of it. And so, you know, it's not that they're not being professional, it's just that they almost, the years fall away from a player like that, you know, because it's almost like, you know, a bonus. You know, and that's the way they tend to play out. That's exactly the eye of the storm that Paul Power was in for that season.
I was just about to say to that, Gary. Stephen makes a great point there. I was about to come to you then, Gary. It's almost like pressure-free football. You know, the fans obviously didn't rate the purchase, didn't rate the sign. There was only ever going to be one way to go, but it's almost like playing with a freedom that perhaps you don't have when there's so much responsibility on you at your original club and the club that you're most associated with.
Yeah, it's a good call. I guess, you know, with a player like Paul Power, you know, as Paul said earlier, you know, to many, it probably looked like a last payday, a last hurrah, going to play for, a bigger team and get a bit of cut the transfer fee, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, he did. He grasped the chance, and I think, you know, there we are. We're back with the sort of, you know, the genius of Kendall. He spotted a guy who had been almost written off by any links with any top club, and not only made him into a decent squad player, but almost made him into an indispensable first choice player. To spot that opportunity, to identify that ability, is. It is pure genius, because, you know, he's not going to go and lay out, you know, outlandish amounts of money for the guy. And he certainly paid him in full, because he was a major contributory factor to Everton's success that season.
Now, talking about success, we'll go the other way. Now, as we all lived through football in the 80s, and there's a lot of things that we think about, but I'm just going to say to you, Paul, plastic pitches.
please don't. I think, I mean, plastic pitches, I'm not a huge fan of plastic pitches, full stop, but I mean, at least the modern ones you can play football on. The two versions I've installed, the Kenilworth Road and Loftus Road, were not conducive to any type of football whatsoever. I'm sure even the home supporters, you know, Luton and QPR, you know, if you speak to them about their views of plastic, watching football on plastic in the 80s, I'm sure that they would, you know, they would always choose grass over plastic. Yeah, I mean, Everton, like a number of top sides, struggled on the plastic surfaces. I think in that 86-87 season, Liverpool got beat by Luton Town, the FA Cup third round, playing on plastic, which they wouldn't have done if they played on grass that season, I'm sure. So, yeah, they were just the players hated playing performing on the pitch because they had to practice. I think part of the problem was that the Luton Town pitch and QPR pitches, although they were both branded with the term plastic pitches, they're completely different playing surfaces. The bounce is different on both surfaces. So you couldn't actually prepare for playing on that type of terrain because Everton used to practice on some all-weather surfaces near Wattenhall Park, which is quite close to both stadiums. But it was nothing like what the surface at Loftus Road or Kenilworth Road was like. Everton struggled to score in league fixtures on both of those two grounds as well. So it was just a fixture that the players just wanted to get out of the way as soon and as quickly as possible. You know, top players like Kevin Sheedy struggled to produce their normal game on that type of surface. Also, it was a massive advantage for the home teams because if you look at QPR and Luton Town's home records in the mid-80s, there was so much superiority to their away record that it was just a massive advantage to be able to play on plastic players home. So when we actually beat QPR 1-0 at the start of January 1987, it was like a huge psychological boost for the club because we'd actually beaten that plastic curse. And I think that was the first time, and I was at that game as well, that was the first time when the away supporters started to think, do you know what? We might actually be in with a chance here because we've actually won on plastic. And it just gave the whole... It was a weight off our backs because even in the 85-86 season, losing 2-1 on Luton Town on plastic in the title run, it had also cost us dearly as well. So it was just good to get that monkey off our backs. And then at the end of the game, I think the players took great delight in just throwing their moulded shoes into the nearest skip. No, they weren't going to have to go there again until the next season. But, I mean, they were hailed as the future football. God, if that had been the future football, I'd have packed them watching in 1988 because they were absolutely awful.
I will come back to you soon, Paul, about key games and stuff as well. But just for you, Stephen, Paul mentioned there about the 1-0 victory on the plastic pitch. As a Liverpool fan, you know, and to be fair, you were very magnanimous at the beginning and, you know, and talked about how Everton were always going to be the threat. I'm not saying was there a point where you took it seriously, but when in the season as a Red, did you start to think, oh, hang on a minute, this could actually go the way of Everton?
I probably
refuse to believe it.
I still think we'll reel them in. Actually, yeah. No, I'd say see, the thing for Liverpool was that we didn't start all that well either. You know, we had a few injury issues ourselves. Grobbelaar missed the first seven. He picked up something like an elbow injury in the Charity Shield. He was replaced by Mike Cooper. And we missed, tellingly, we missed Steve Nicol for two-thirds of the season. And this is where I think the tip imbalance is that, you know, whereas Everton got such great purchase out of Paul Power and Alan Harper being able to plug, you know, a multitude of positions, our own jack-of-all-trades, master of them all, Steve Nicol, was missing. It was his most injury-hit season. And I think that was the big turn. I mean, and we lost some big injuries that season. You know, Jim Beglin to a horrendous broken leg. You know, Mark Lawrenson ruptured his Achilles towards the tail end. Kevin McDonald went into a 50-50 challenge at Southampton with the uncompromising Mark Dennis and came away with a double leg fracture. You know, we had our own issues, but, you know, the same as Everton, it was a case of here's our template, here are the pieces, and you know, we plugged every gap virtually. But yeah, it got too much eventually. But we had an unbeaten run. We were beaten by Man United on Boxing Day at home, 1-0. And then we didn't lose again in the league until late March at Tottenham. So we were actually bubbling along quite nicely. You know, it did look like we were going to win it. I think we were 9 clear at one point, although having played 2 games more. You know, but I think as late as March, mid-March, I think we won at QPR and in the middle of March, towards the tail end of March, and it just looked like, you know, it was going to be us again. But the wheels just unceremoniously fell off in a very unusual way for Liverpool. You know, Liverpool were very, very markedly about the strong running. This was the Liverpool calling card, was the strong running. So we'd actually put ourselves into a very strong position. But then I think we lost something like 5 of the last 9, which was just very un-Liverpool-like. So yeah, you know, as late as the very tail end of March, you know, we were convinced it was Liverpool's title. But then the fact that it was Everton that was coming through on the rails, you know, was the unsettling thing. Nottingham Forest had led for quite some time early on, played very good football in doing so as well. It tends to go forgotten about this season because Tottenham get a great deal of credit for this season, despite coming away with nothing. And rightly so in a way, because they were a wonderful side that played some great football. And very unusually, with the formation they had was kind of like a 4-5-1, but a very attacking 4-5-1, which was basically 4-3-3 when they were on the front foot. So, you know, they were a very kind of like forward-thinking side. And then you had Arsenal led the table. So, you know, it was one of these where the baton was passed. Forest, then Arsenal, then ourselves, then Everton came through. You know, Tottenham were omnipresent yet. I don't think they led the table at all at any point whatsoever. So, yeah, you know, as late as late March, we were of the mind that it was nothing other than a Liverpool title win. But once the others had fallen away and it was just Everton coming through, then, you know, yeah, you know, there were two results. There were two weekends running where the tilt was. And it was a fortuitous or jammy, as we would call it, win against Charlton. So a bit of a freak goal from Gary Stevens, I seem to recall. And then they won at Arsenal. You know, they were the two clinching games, really, that twisted the title chase, you know, in a completely different direction. But yeah, as late as March, late March, you know, we were looking at another Liverpool title win.
Like I said, I'm going to come back to you, Paul, for some of the key games and just to see how jammy that goal and that result
was jammy.
When you write a book about Liverpool losing the league that season, Stephen, I'm
going to write the 85-86 book and put Paul through.
Please don't invite me on that pod. I might have another stag doing that night.
For you, Gary, listening to Paul and Stephen chat there, these, and this is probably just my age, and I get that, and football moves on, but league titles, league campaigns seem to be a real slog. And, you know, that, as Stephen mentioned there, the, you know, the passing of the baton, it would be one team, then another, then another, then another. And to me, the almost attrition that is a league campaign seems to have disappeared from modern football, certainly in the Premiership.
I think there's probably a couple of reasons for that. Well, I mean, there's probably more than a couple of reasons, but a couple of reasons come to mind. Firstly, the massive squads teams have now, especially the top teams. Top teams now don't have 11 first-choice players. They have 17, 18 first-choice players. You know, they have a squad full of internationals. You know, it just sort of, going back to what Paul mentioned earlier about a guy like Al Harper. I mean, of those Everton players, that Everton team of that era, you know, you could say, well, not many played. I can tell you what he played. Yeah, because he's either midfield, he's forward or whatever. Al Harper, you wouldn't have been surprised if he turned up in goal. He played defence, he played midfield he played, on the wide. Such a wonderful player. But each team was successful, had to have a player like that. And, you know, Stevie mentioned about Steve Nicol. Nowadays, that's not the case. As I say, you know, coaches rotate squad first team selection all the time because they've got so many international players. So that's why it perhaps doesn't feel like such a slog there, because you rarely see players, perhaps, you know, you might be a defender and goalkeeper will play almost all the games of the season, but very few other positions. And I think the second thing is now, and this is perhaps criticism of modern football, is the league title isn't what it used to be. For the top teams, you know, it's qualifying for the Champions League, it's winning the Champions League, which we did, by the way, last season, by the way. The Premier, the winning the first division title, I mean, for much of my life, and even to the start of the Premier League itself, that was the be-all and end-all. You'd rather win the title than win a European pot, almost. So I think those things have changed to make it seem less of a slog, because, I think that there's far more players that coaches can call on, and B, I think it's not the all-important thing that it used to be.
That's a fair comment. And obviously, something we will touch on before we finish, sure, and that's the lack of European football as well. Yeah. So at that point in time, point, you know, yeah, it was the number one trophy to win.
I could come to the plastic pictures. Of course. It was a real fascinating read, this part of the book, because I remember the plastic pictures really well. And, you know, Paul mentioned, you know, you can get different bounces on different pitches. Let me tell you, you could get different bounces on the same pitch. I mean, there was no calculation of where, and it was like a totally different game, because teams going to visit Kenilworth Road, Loftus Road, where the plastic pitches were, couldn't play their normal game. They had to change the game because the pitches didn't allow them to play that. And I won't say it was cheating, but it wasn't far short.
Yeah, exactly.
I think they're probably a podcast all by themselves, plastic pitches. Okay, Paul, so, you know, like you say, you know, the book is it's a brilliant insight into this season. It's a real look under the microscope at a single season, the twists, the turns, the personnel. But, you know, for you, we've had Stephen's perspective on the key games. Your perspective on where the title was won, or where you maybe started to believe, you know, you mentioned the 1-0 win on the plastic pitch, but where were the key games in that campaign?
Well, I would just backtrack slightly, Sue. So I think it's worth bearing in mind that one thing that helped Everton 86-87 was the fact we'd done it before two seasons previously. So Kendall had the experience there that he knew what was required from the team to get them over the line. And he always played great emphasis on the Christmas and Easter periods. And we had two surges at those times of the season. We won six league games on the bounce of Christmas, seven league games on the bounce of Easter. And they were quite crucial in seeing us over the line. Another fact that people can underestimate as well is the 84-85 side were also playing in Europe as well. So they had the benefits of European competition alongside the league campaign, which is pushing their performances to a higher level each time. In the 86-87 season, we were quagmired in meaningless competitions such as the full members cup and the super screen sports trophy. So the 86-87 team had a lot of obstacles in the way of progressing towards the title. Now, I mean, Stephen mentioned there about that training routine with Gary Stevens, which the team had practiced week in, week out, which led to that winning goal against Charlton Athletic, which turned the title back in our favour.
A brilliant goal, by the way,
Oh, it was, yeah. And, you know, it's just Jammy. Joke of practice made perfect, you know. I mean, the number of times we've rehearsed a defender hissing the ball against a fullback and bouncing the fullback's shin and going 30 yards in top corner in the net. Those things don't happen by accident, you know. It's a lot of preparation, a lot of detail, a lot of practice, and it paid dividends there. But yeah, I think that win was crucial. I think it was the weekend, the 21st of March. And it became more crucial the next day when Liverpool lost to Tottenham, because that was the end of Liverpool's winning run, I think, of 11 games unbeaten, which Stephen touched upon there. So that was a crucial weekend as well. And then the two away wins in London were absolutely vital in terms of delivering the title to Goodison Park, because the 1-0 win at Arsenal, and you know, Arsenal were still in contention for the title then. I think we were the first team to win there that season. And the win at Chelsea, we won 2-1 that day. I think with the score of one each, Chelsea were actually playing us off the park, and Neville Southall single-handedly kept us in the game. And they're out of nowhere. And one of the things about the 86-87 team was they could score goals from the most unlikely sources, you know, from the Bobby Hayes, Gary Stevens training routine to what we did in the game against Chelsea. So suddenly Alan Harper finds himself in acres of space, 30 yards from goal. He hits this humdinger of a shot that suddenly is buried in the back of the Chelsea net. And Everton fans were there looking stunned. What on earth is going on here? And that turned the game in our favour. In fact, 5 minutes later, he repeated the same shot and it hit the crossbar. And the mud stain remained on the crossbar for the rest of the match. So it was just a superb performance from a player who never quite got the recognition he deserved. He was an unsung hero. I mean, I think in modern football, you don't. Gary touched on before about the strength and depth of squad. You don't get utility players in the same mould that you did in the 80s. But Alan Harper would slot in anywhere in the team. And Howard Kendall would know he would give a first-class performance no matter where he happens to play. But that winning goal against Chelsea really lifted the spirits of the team and the fans. And also, we'd struggled against London teams a bit that season. So to have two consecutive away wins in the capital really gave the club an impetus towards going on. And I think at the end of that game, we got on top of the table for the first time in close up with Liverpool. And then things got better the next day because Liverpool played in the League Cup final against Arsenal. And Ian Rush scored. And as an Everton fan, you got sick of him. Oh, Liverpool never lose when Ian Rush scored. And it went on and on and on. And I went out that afternoon. And I was supposed to tee off, think that's it, they've won the League Cup. Came back and found out that actually they'd lost. And so that was another massive psychological blow because suddenly it no longer meant that if Ian Rush scored, Liverpool were not going to lose. So that also turned things around quite a bit as well. So I think the two away wins in the capital were crucial. Stephen touched upon that weekend of Liverpool losing at Tottenham, us beating Charlton Athletic with, you know, even I'd have to describe as a fortuitous goal, really turned the tide in Everton's favour. And I think Kendall had the team so well prepared that the self-belief and the experience starts to show once they got themselves top of the table again. And maybe some bizarre way, blown the title the season before, had made this team more determined not to let this happen the second time again. They'd learn from that experience. So there was a general feeling then with Liverpool stumbling, Everton hitting form at the right time. And you know, as an Everton fan, you're never totally convinced it's happening until it's happened. But there was a slight feeling, some kind of optimism started to emerge on terraces and Glover Street at that time.
It's like I say, I mean, you know, you guys have all supported teams that have won top flight championships, and Stephen, having just had a chat with Gary about the attrition that is a football season, or that was a football season in the 80s, it still fascinates me how you can actually pinpoint almost seconds. You know, you can put what you know could have been a 42 game season, a 42 game campaign, and you can identify 2 or 3 seconds where everything changes when you're probably looking at the best part of 75 hours of football, and you know, and it's just those couple of seconds that actually define or provide the ultimate outcome.
Yes, with a league title, you tend to be deflected towards it one way or another. You know, there are a lot of variables that take you to a league title. Some teams run away with it, but some are kind of like closely contested, and there are the finest of lines, Will. You know, certain forks in the road where you look back and think, oh, it could have gone very, very different there. And you do, and you will have eventually, you know, you'll come to identify a certain pathway towards winning a league title. And this was it. You know, these were the Everton stepping stones into winning it. Yes, you know, I do. I remember those stepping stones very, very well.
And I suppose, you know, again, you know, same with you, Gary. I think, you know, we sort of touched on before about the lack of European football. And I guess at that time, the league title became everything. You know, the First Division title became everything in that period of time. And so although there wasn't the saturation coverage, as Paul mentioned right at the beginning, you know, how, you know, 1 minute, 15 seconds on the news. But actually those lead campaigns were almost poured over via the back pages, you know, via the fans who were there, because it was the very centre of their footballing world for that season.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking a period really now where, you know, I mentioned earlier about the league title being diminished. It certainly wasn't those days. It was the thing, because it was almost the only thing. I mean, the FA Cup as well. But, you know, these sort of Mickey Mouse competitions that Paul referred to earlier. I love the full screen super duper. dreamed up the league with the FA, combination of the two, dreamed up these crazy schemes to sort of compensate for the lack of European football. And I mean, they were just abominations. So yeah, I mean, the league title was the thing, and yes, it seems strange. It seems ridiculously strange from modern perspective to look back and say some of those key games. I think I remember Paul saying in the book that the derby towards the end of the season wasn't even covered.
It wasn't because both ITV and BBC had used their allocation of live games for the season, and the Football League said there was some kind of obstacles that would have prevented the game being broadcast live, and both clubs wanted broadcast live because, you know, it was the game of the season, and how the Football League authorities decided not to allow that broadcast to be transmitted. It defies any logical analysis.
It doesn't, as I say, you know, this was a chance for the league to sort of, you know, re-establish itself as the main competition. To, you know, we are not the important thing. We're the only thing, you know, and yet they failed it, I think, miserably. And I think this is why, you know, I mentioned earlier that, you know, as well as becoming the forgotten champions, it's almost because they're unseen. There was very little coverage on TV of it. And yet, as you say, that, you know, the newspapers would have very little else to cover. But yeah, it was a strange time for football, especially as you look back from a modern perspective.
It leads brilliantly into my next question, although I haven't quite worked out how to phrase it yet, Paul, so you need to bear with me on this. So, following Everton's 84-85 win, and then obviously the unfortunate relinquishing of titles to Liverpool, do you think a European Cup campaign in that 85-86 season would have in any way affected, enhanced, deviated the course of what happened the following season? I know it's very difficult to say, you know, with hindsight and things, but in terms of that, the lack of, or the missed opportunity of European Cup football, you know, do you think there was any element of that that impacted on this season?
Yeah, I think so, Stuart. I mean, I'm sure Steve will back me up on this, but certainly Liverpool benefits from regular European competition when they're winning league titles to go with that as well. So I think, undoubtedly, if Everton had been in Europe in 85-86, I think that would have impacted positively on the performances of the club last season. I mean, that's not to say we would have won the double that season, but it certainly would have been an added factor to the team. And certainly, I think, for the start of the 85-86 season, Everton had like the bounce of having won the European competition the year before. Now, when we went into 86-87, we didn't have that European bounce to start the season off on a strong footing. So I think that was always a difficulty for the side to overcome. And I think another thing with the 86-87 campaign is it's hard to underestimate the demoralising effect that it had on Howard Kendall as a manager and on the players, the fact they weren't going to be able to compete in Europe if they won the league at the end of that season. I think, you know, regardless of what the fan base thought about Gary Lineker, he, I think, undoubtedly would have stayed if we had European competition in 85-86 and 86-87. And a number of Everton key players who then moved up to Scotland, such as Gary Stevens, Trevor Stephen, would have stayed at the club should a European competition have been an option for the club. So, yeah, it definitely impacted upon the 86-87 season. I think it shows that the motivational skills of Kendall and his backroom staff to keep the team focused. And it also shows, you know, the resilience of the players, that they didn't let the despondency about the lack of European competition deflate deflate their progress or their performance that season. And also, I think we've had the great credits on the fans as well, because, you know, for the fans, it was a real downer not being able to compete in Europe. I mean, I was working as a teacher then, and the European Companies Cup final was on a Wednesday night, which meant I couldn't go because I was at school the next day. And there were two really strong memories from that season for me. One is that at the time, there was a 3-day rolling strike program going on by one of the teaching unions, the NUT. So if you're an NUT member, the school I was working in had Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday off of that week, and the wages were getting paid by the union. I was in the union that I chose not to go on strike, so I was stuck in school. I mean, how ironic is that? And then I had a ticket, but I couldn't go to the game. This sort of the devil on your shoulder sort of thing, you know, and the angel there. I had the ticket in my hand, so I just ring up school, say I'm ill, I can't come in today. But it was so obvious that I wouldn't have been ill. I let my professional standards get the best of me, and I regret that to this day, because I remember watching on TV at the time thinking, it's okay, we'll be in Europe again next year, there'll be a lot of opportunities. And there were no further opportunities. That's only one thing in life. You've got to grab these opportunities when they appear on the horizon.
I have a lot of respect for that comment, Paul. I'm not going to lie. A lot of respect for it. A quick question to put you on the spot. Would Everton have won the European Cup in 85-86?
Well, I mean, we spoke with Stephen about this before. It's impossible to answer. It really is. It could depend on the look of the draw. It depends on the key entry. I think it's fair to say, you know, we were strong contenders for our competition. Now, whether lack of experience might have worked against us, I don't know. We could have been given a really tough draw away in the first round, which always seems to happen when we get to European competition. So I would like to think yes, but I can't honestly sit here and say, oh, yeah, we would have won it because there's that and the other. Because cup competitions, as Gary will testify from Chelsea's win in 2011, so many things can change, and suddenly a competition that you think you're on target to win, you kind of, that opportunity goes. And likewise, a most unlikely team could come through and win the competition that season. So to try and succinctly answer your question, yes, we were strong contenders. Would we win it? I hope so, but I can't 100% hand in heart say yes, we would have done.
Off air, before we came on, Stephen said that yes, you definitely would have. Yeah, he did say that. In the strictest of confidence.
For my money, they'd have gone either very, very close or fallen at the first hurdle. I mean, they were actually in the hat. This is something I've covered in the books. Like I've read, they were in the hat for the first round draw for the sake of balance, as Manchester United were as well for the Cup Winners' Cup. And Everton would have been paired up with Anderlecht, you know, in that first round of the 85-86 European Cup. And I think it would have been a case of going far or hitting the wall straight away. You know, they'd have fallen at the first hurdle. And that being an Anderlecht side that wasn't adverse to buying results off English clubs at the time. You know, who's you know. But yeah, no, interesting hypotheticals. But yeah, I do. I think that Everton side would have done one or the other. It's all or nothing for me there.
Who won it that year?
Who won it? That was
Stau Bucharest. Oh, it's the Barcelona game.
Yeah.
I think there's a book coming out, Gary, that's got the answers to that quite soon. I'm not sure. I think there is. I think there's a book coming out soon. I think I've seen it.
Yeah,
we might see if we can get the author on. See if he knows anything about the European Cup.
But no, I mean, regards that Everton side had every. You know, every facet, every tool to have come very, very close.
Yeah.
I mean, like I say, Paul, the book is wonderful. You know, it's a fantastic read, and I always think having written a book about essentially five games, it can be really difficult to distill an entire book into quite a microcosm of time. But one last thing that I want to sort of chat with you about, and that's Howard Kendall, and you know how he's perceived. You know, I mentioned to Gary about, you know, was it his greatest success, you know, from an independent perspective, but obviously for you as a lifelong Everton fan who has seen an awful lot of managers before Howard Kendall and an awful lot of managers, probably even far more managers after Howard Kendall. To you, where did he sit? What does he mean to you? And now I can ask the same question that I asked to Gary, you know, was this his greatest achievement?
Yeah, bearing in mind in 86, 87, we didn't have a European competition to compete in. I think it's of league performance. It certainly was. I mean, that's why it would have been so interesting if we'd been in Europe in 86, 87, because then you could have a real comparison with the 84, 85 achievements as well. I think it's also, Howard Kendall, by the time he won the league in 1987, he was 40. So by the time he was 40, he delivered two league titles, an FA Cup and a European Cup Winners' Cup, which is a tremendous achievement for a manager who was still relatively young and had only managed to top division side for six seasons. So that was a kind of reflection of how good he was. I think tactically for the time, he was way ahead of lots of coaches in terms of the routines, the practicing, the drills, etc., that they employed in training. He was good at knowing where the team needed improvement and being prepared to make those improvements. If a player's time at Everton was done, he had no qualms about letting them go. So he let Andy Gray go because he thought Gary Lineker was the best solution. He more or less froze Derek Mountford out because he thought Dave Watson was the best solution. He let Paul Wilkerson go because he thought Wayne Clark was the best solution. So whenever he felt there was a player's time at the club was done, he'd have no compunction in just letting them go. So he was ruthless, but that's a quality you need to have if you're going to deliver league titles. I think as well, when we spoke to Paul Power, it was good getting Paul Power's perspective on Howard Kendall because he was an outsider who came in, who obviously had some preconceived ideas about what Kendall would be like, but I think he kind of conveyed to us that he thought Howard Kendall was the best manager he'd ever worked under. He thought on the training ground he was superb in terms of team preparation. He thought in the dressing room he could be one of the lads. You'd have a joke with him, but didn't go too far. In terms of handling the media, he was absolutely superb. In terms of relation to the boardroom, the directors, he had them on side as well. And he also had this great relationship with the fans. So all the key elements of the manager's job, he seemed to carry off seamlessly. And I think Steve might correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think he's the last English manager to have won a European trophy with an English club with that Cup Winners' Cup in 85. So I think his achievements have also kind of been glossed over by his subsequent return to Goodison's, which were quite underwhelming compared to his original spell in charge. So from my perspective, as a supporter, he's the best manager I've known. And unlike Harry Kadrick, he delivered two titles in three seasons. He kept that momentum going. And I think, unfortunately for Everton, the lack of European competition meant that by the end of 1987, he was kind of faced with a situation where he's thinking, well, do I really want to do this again? The team needs some more rebuild. I've just won the league twice in three seasons. What is there here to push me to the next level? Because he made no secrets of the fact he was missing European competition. He made no secret of the fact how frustrating that was for him. So I think his departure was unexpected and expected, if that kind of makes sense, because we were really hoping he would stay. He was saying all the right things. But if you read between the lines of his statements and going back researching the book, you see that was more glaringly obvious than what I thought at the time. You could see that he was itching to test himself at the next level. And I think what's really cost Everton quite dear is after he left in 87, and although Colin Harvey seemed the natural successor as following the Liverpool model with Bob Paisley, the problem Everton had was by appointing Harvey as manager, he lost the skills of Harvey, the coach. Harvey as a coach was absolutely superb. Promoting to manager really took away his strongest suit. And when you think at the time, we also lost Mick Heaton, who'd been Kendall's partner from his days at Blackburn, who's another underrated contributor to the backroom staff at Everton. He went as well. So effectively, Everton lost their entire coaching staff that summer. And then the appointments that came in were Mick Lyons and Teddy Daricott, neither of whom inspired the fans with their previous records at Everton. And so straight away, we got from a situation where we had England's top manager, England's top coach, and they've just gone, and the club really, really has never recovered from Howard Kendall's departure.
So just jump in there, I'd say the similarities between Clough and Peter Taylor there is that they never quite worked the magic apart that they did together. And I think Kendall's post-Everton, and when I say post-Everton, is leaving the first time around, his record elsewhere wasn't all add up to scratch. You know, he did all right. You know, he didn't disgrace himself in Spain, but he never won anything. You know, a year at Man City that straddled two seasons, and he seemed to be putting a decent side together. You know, it never quite fell into place for him. I mean, the fact that he was still at an age when, you know, like Paul said, you know, he was only in his 40s, early 40s when he left. So he wasn't you know, mid-40s when he returned. He should have still been in a position to be able to do stuff. And you know, I do think it was just one of those partnerships that the two of them worked best together, you know, than apart. And although they came back together 1991, it was strange circumstances for Colin Harvey to be sacked as Everton manager and then return 2 days later as coach to Kendall. You know, that meant that all of any animosity that was in the dressing room from the previous manager being sacked alleviated like a pressure cooker from going, and then he returns 48 hours later back into the employment of the club, back into that dressing room. You know, a degree of, you know, the right partnership at the wrong time by the time it is revisited.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point, Stephen. I think also as well, I think Colin Harvey in his book about his time, because he also said that when Howard Kendall came back for the second time, he wasn't the same Howard Kendall that he'd worked with when he left at the end of 87. And that's why that partnership was not quite as effective second time around, because he felt Kendall had changed in some negative ways compared to the person he'd worked with previously. So that could be why that success was to be pieced. Those kind of begs the question as well. You know, I mean, when the England job was being touted, I mean, Howard Kendall was never kind of, you know, pushed forward as being a possible contender for the England job, similar to Brian Clough. You know,
there was rumours that he was invited to interview for the job and he turned it down. And I always got the idea with Kendall in that position was that he'd seen the torture at times that Bobby Robson had gone through and thought, I don't want any of that. I think if you could have taken away, you know, all of that rancor that came with the job, then it would have been the perfect job for him. He would have been the perfect successor to Bobby Robson in 1990. And I think it's the excellent Gavin Buckland, who's mentioned this a few times. Who's a brilliant, another brilliant Evertonian, and he's mentioned these sliding doors issues and stuff like that. And it is it's a fascinating kind of like period where, I don't know, it's almost like sometimes a club is compelled to make a decision or to bring someone back. You know, from a Liverpool perspective, the similarity would be bringing Ian Rush back as a player. We didn't need him. You know, we didn't need to sign him. It was the wrong thing to do. But you're compelled to do it because, you know, and because you want to, I don't know, revisit what's been before. You know, Kendall was the right man at the wrong time when he returned. You know, and it's fascinating in so many levels.
It's we've worked together far too long. I say it quite often, but my question that I've written down for Gary was literally, what do you think, or would he have made a good England manager? Was the question that I've got written for Gary.
I refer you to my colleague's earlier answer. I think the short answer, you never know. You never know. And just briefly about the Harvey Kendall situation is, in the poor profession, if you prove to be a really, really good teacher, they make you a head teacher. And as a head teacher, the last thing you're doing is teaching. Basically, they make you an administrator. And it's a similar sort of thing with Harvey when Kendall left. And Harvey was a great coach, and they promoted him, and he stopped being a coach. So all the things he was really good at, they stopped him doing. So, I mean, it's just a bit weird, that sort of thing. But going back to you said about England, man, it's so difficult to say. You know, there's been many England managers appointed to coach England who've been abject failures. I mean, they've been great at clubs. Revy, for example. And yet some of the perhaps the most popular managers never got the chance. Kendall. I mean, I heard a rumour, I don't know whether it's true, that he was invited to go for an interview, and he said, basically, words to the effect of, well, what do you want to ask me that you don't already know about me? I mean, you know, it just seems a nonsense thing, you know. I mean, you go for you go for a job interview, to find out about the person. Well, for God's sake, you know, this guy, well, perhaps the FA didn't know because they're quite probably too intent on their gin and tonics and finding a new tie. But it just, you just never know. Some managers take on the international job. It's so different from a club. It's so different from a club. I mean, Graham Taylor, for example, excellent club manager, has a different thing. You don't get to work with players every day. You hardly see them from, I mean, it's slightly different there in those days. You know, you might have six or seven internationals a season at most. So you don't see the players all the time, and then you go around watching players and watching opposition. It's a totally different thing. So good club managers don't necessarily make great international managers, and vice versa. So who knows? Who knows? It's one of those questions we'll never know the answer to. You should have got a chance.
Stu, can I just come in one last thing, Howard Kendall? There, yeah, of course. Well, I think as well, there's an interesting parallel between Kendall's playing career and his managerial career, because in both, he achieved success at an early age, but never really went on to develop it. So as a player, you know, he won the league with Everton when he was 24, but never won another title in his career. As a manager, he'd won, you know, so many things by the age of 40, but then after the age of 40, it just dried up suddenly. So it's not as if like he was the type of person who had to spend years trying to get to the top, and then when he got to the top, was able to push on. He'd actually hit the top from quite an early age, and then it was more or less, sadly, a slow decline after that, and a struggle to repeat those early successes. And I think sometimes there's a time for managers to be at their peak, and I think for Kendall, his style of management, particularly with the drinking culture in football at that time, and in particular Goodison Park, that would never survive in the Premier League days. Things Brian Clough found out as well. So there's a time for the manager to be at the peak of his powers, and that was Kendall's time. I think his attempts to repeat that, football moved on, and he hadn't quite moved on the same way with it.
I think that's it's a great place to end it, as much as I don't want to end it. That's it. An hour and a half has gone already. And if you can imagine how easy the listener's been, and how much there is to chat about, you can only imagine how much is in the book and the content, the detail that Paul goes into, the memories, the perspective, the opinions of others who were there, who lived it, played it. It's, like I say, it's brilliant. It sits, you know, clearly in my sweet spot of football, and when I, you know, when I liked watching football, when to me football was at its greatest, even though arguably it probably wasn't at all, but for me it was, because of my age.
No, you're right, Stu. It was.
Thank you. you know, it's just a brilliant book, Paul. It really is. And like I said, considering it's your first book, it's quite the bar you've set yourself, as I like to say to my students.
Well, thanks to you. But can I just say that I've been inspired by yourself, Gary and Stephen, because the books you've written I've devoured from start to finish. And that was really inspiration before me to get me to actually pick up to get on the keyboard and start putting something together. And I like to think I've taken elements of each of your books in my writing as well. So thank you for the support you give me with that.
To be fair, it's Gary and Stephen that are a nightmare. The worst thing is, Paul, let me tell you, the worst thing is they don't even stop at one. They don't even let you get caught up. They don't go brilliant, they're all the same. They just carry on. Gary, enjoyed it?
Yeah, it was always going to be a great chat. It's a terrific book. And, you know, it's a bit like we were talking about Jeff Golding's book about Liverpool in the 20s. You don't have to be a fan of a club to know this is a great story. And, I mean, this is obviously, you know, it's a popular club, so lots of people will know the story. But the depth that Paul goes into and the sort of conversations he's had with people who are involved just adds that extra little layer of intensity to the story. So it's a great story, great book. I recommend anybody to buy it. If you're interested in football, great book to read.
Stephen, as a red, I'm assuming you'll be recommending it.
To
all your friends.
No, most definitely. I mean, I'm lucky enough to have a phalanx of you know, excellent blue friends, and say you don't need to be an Everton fan. I mean, if you have an interest in the football of this era, football anyway. You know, this is a brilliantly well-written book, beautifully researched and put together. You know, I've read through it as a Liverpool fan and ticked off all the kind of like, yeah, remember this, remember that, remember the other. And it's been like a little bit of therapy to read it from the other side of the garden fence, you know, in a way. It's like kicking your ball over the neighbour's fence and having to go back and get it. And then, yeah. So this is kind of what it's been like for me. And I still now, you know, covet Trevor Stephen. You know, that's the thing, you know, of that Everton side, you know, Neville Southall would be the obvious choice if you could transplant one of those players into the Liverpool side of that era. Trevor Stephen would actually be the one. You know, he had a wonderful campaign that year and he was just, the most Liverpool of Everton players in a way. This is a spectacularly brilliant book, and go out and buy it.
I think on the back of your book, Paul, the testimony is like a look over your neighbour's fence. needs to go on the back or even the front of your book. Obviously, we won't record this bit, Paul. I promise. Have you got any ideas for another one?
Well, I mean, I don't. You've all been through this process before. I mean, one of the things I decided to do once the book was finished was kind of to reintroduce myself to my wife and my son because they hadn't seen me for 6 months. There's this rumor going around. I was renting a room in our house because nobody's seen me for so long. So I'm actually quite enjoying having a break from thinking about books at the moment. But yeah, I've got a few ideas in my mind, whether it's another book about Everton or whether I try something different with, you know, a more sort of a wider ranging book about football from a particular year, decade. I'm not quite sure, but definitely give it some thought. But I've not decided anything yet. I think it's just a case that, as I did with this book, is pick up the laptop, start typing a few things, put a proposal out to pitch, and then take it from there and see how it goes. But I know I'm in at least company here because I don't want to be seen as a one-off wonder like a sort of Nottingham Forest or something like that. You know? I realise I'm in elite company here. So yeah, it's definitely been given some very, very serious consideration. And as I say, from reading the volumes of work that you three have all produced, it just really did give me the impetus and the inspiration to go and have a go doing this myself. And thanks so much for all the support you give me in seeing this project over the line.
It's sensational. It really is. It's the Forgotten Champions, but clearly not by you, Paul. but it's the Forgotten Champions. It's the 86-87 Everton's last... Well, I won't say last. I nearly said last ever. I'm really sorry. It's the last ever title win.
I'm about to the Bee Gees and walk off the show here, like a Clive Anderson.
Currently their last title win. It's wonderful. You know, congratulations. You know, I hope it gets all the recognition that it deserves, and like I say, hopefully it won't. But don't hang out with Stephen and Gary if you're not intending on writing again soon. Yeah, it's a wonderful book. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast, but even more so, thank you for writing it.
Thanks, Stu. It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show. And just to remind anyone who's listening, it's out on 27th of September, Pitch Publishing. Make sure you get a copy, whether you're blue or not blue. And if you want to look over your garden neighbour's fence, this is the ideal book for you.
when you've read it, you can stand on it to have a look over your neighbour's fence. Brilliant. And all that's left for me to say is thank you for listening. Paul's right. He clearly knows when his book's due out. Make sure you go out and get a copy. Also, have a look over your neighbour's fence tomorrow if you're fast.
I particularly like Paul's selection of Everton garden gnomes as well. I resisted the temptation to kick them over
thank you for joining us. Where next time we'll probably chat about someone else's garden gnome.
It's hosting himself, Stu.
Thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.